Hello, I'm Joseph Kassa, and welcome to this podcast where the AI team does a deep dive into some application of systems thinking.
Welcome to another deep dive. This time around, we're taking a trip back to the year 2000.
Ooh, the year 2000.
Y2K?
All the computers were supposed to crash.
We survived.
Yep,
barely.
But made it.
We made it, but someone saw it coming, and he wrote this paper all about it.
Really?
How collaboration via the World Wide Web can provide a global perspective and truly provide the student with a world-class education, by Joseph Kassa.
That's a mouthful.
It is a mouthful, but it is also a fascinating look at what people back in the year 2000 thought education would be like today.
I'm really interested to hear about this.
Especially in IT, because that's his area of expertise and focus, and we have you here who also has a lot of expertise in that area.
Yes, I do.
So let's jump in.
Let's do it.
Now, what jumped out at me right away is that Kassa was already seeing a problem that we're still grappling with today.
Oh, yeah. What's that?
The huge demand for skilled IT professionals, particularly software engineers.
Oh, for sure.
But a real shortage of qualified instructors, especially those with the doctorates that are required by all those fancy accreditation boards.
Yeah, and that has not gone away at all.
No.
If anything, it's just gotten more intense.
Absolutely.
With the rise of like data science and AI.
Yeah, all these new fields.
Everything's moving so fast.
Yeah, and all the universities are like, we need someone to teach this. Well, I'm still learning it myself.
Exactly. Yeah, it's really hard to find people who've been in the field long enough to have that deep expertise and also have gone through the whole academic process to get a doctorate.
So back in 2000, what did Kassa think we should do about this?
Well, remember, this is 2000.
The internet was still pretty young then, wasn't it?
It was. We were all on dial-up.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that sound?
And those awful AOL discs.
Oh, yeah. You had like a stack of them.
But even then, he saw the potential of distance learning as a solution to this whole problem.
Interesting.
He even highlights this example.
Okay.
A software engineering class with a professor in Australia.
Wow. Australia.
And a teaching assistant in Maryland.
Okay, so already across the globe.
Yeah, and they were using asynchronous audio lectures, web forums, and then occasional live calls.
Wow, so they were already thinking about blended learning.
It really is amazing to think about how much we've progressed since then.
Yeah, we've come a long way.
But what I found even more fascinating is that Kassa didn't stop at just online courses.
Oh, really?
He had this much grander vision.
Oh.
He was thinking about universities all over the world.
Oh, wow.
Collaborating to offer joint degrees.
That's a really cool idea.
So instead of every single university trying to be like the best at everything and having every single subject, they could really just focus on what they do best and then create these really amazing learning experiences for students.
Oh, I love that idea.
So for example, just imagine a student in India taking a design course, but the course is using virtual reality. And it's being taught by an expert in the U.S.
Oh, wow.
Or a student in England. Who's able to access unique research data from a partner university in Australia?
Yeah, that makes so much sense because each university has its own strengths and resources.
Absolutely.
So why not share them and make the most of what's out there?
Exactly.
Like, it's a good global knowledge network.
Exactly.
It's exciting just thinking about the possibilities.
Yeah, I know.
But of course, it's not all sunshine and roses.
It never is it?
No.
As much as we can imagine this amazing future, we have to be realistic too.
Yeah. I mean, getting universities to collaborate like that is a huge hurdle.
Yeah. I can't even get different departments in the same university to agree on things half the time.
Exactly. It's like herding cats.
Sometimes I feel like it.
So imagine trying to get universities from different countries with different cultures, different priorities, all on the same page.
Oh, yeah.
It's a logistical nightmare.
Oh, yeah.
And then there's the whole competition thing.
Right. Because even though we think about them as these institutions of higher learning, they are businesses, too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. They're competing for students for funding for prestige.
Yeah. So it's really hard for them to set aside those competitive instincts.
It's like asking rival tech companies to share their top secret algorithms.
This is true.
Not going to happen easily.
So did Kassa have any ideas about how to make this collaboration thing actually work?
Well, he was actually aware of all these challenges.
Okay.
And he suggests what he calls a more gradual approach.
Okay.
So start small.
Okay.
Maybe with institutions that already have some common ground.
So like if they have a history of working together or something.
Exactly. Or they have similar research interests.
Okay.
Or they're geographically close.
Okay.
Something to kind of ease them into this whole collaboration thing.
So baby steps.
Baby steps, exactly.
Okay.
Build some trust, show the benefits of working together.
Okay.
And then maybe they can take on bigger projects down the line.
So it's like a proof of concept.
Exactly.
Okay. So start small, build trust, and then hopefully things can expand from there.
That's the idea.
And he really emphasizes this idea of strong leadership.
Yes, leadership is key.
Okay.
You need people within each university who are really committed to this vision.
So they have to buy into it.
They have to be true believers.
Okay.
Because they're the ones who are going to have to push for change.
So they're going to have to convince all the other faculty and the administration and everyone.
Exactly. They need to be persuasive. They need to be persistent.
So they're going to be ready for a fight.
It's not going to be easy.
That's for sure.
But Kasser believed that if you have the right people in place, it can be done.
Okay, so strong leadership is crucial. But then he also throws out this other really radical idea.
Oh, really? Let's hear it.
The customer contractor model for instructors.
Okay, that sounds intriguing.
It is. So imagine this. Instead of the traditional professor-university relationship,
right,
universities become the clients.
Oh, okay.
And instructors become the contractors.
Huh.
And they bid on courses based on their expertise, yeah, their experience, their student reviews, even their cost.
So it's like a free market for teaching.
In a way, it is, and it's so different from how we typically think about education.
Yeah, it really challenges the status quo.
It does. So what do you think about that? Like, what are the potential benefits and drawbacks of applying market principles to education like that?
Well, on the one hand, it could create a more dynamic and responsive system.
Okay, how so?
Well, universities could tap into a much wider pool of talent and expertise.
Right, because they wouldn't be limited to just the professors who happen to be employed by that specific university.
Exactly. They could find the best person for the job no matter where they are in the world.
Okay.
And instructors could potentially earn more based on their performance and the demand for their courses.
So it incentivizes them to really up their game and stay on top of their field.
Exactly. They'd have to keep innovating, keep improving to stay competitive.
Yeah, I can see how that could really benefit students, because they'd be getting access to the most cutting-edge knowledge and the most engaging instructors.
Right. And it could also be a huge boon for institutions with limited resources.
Okay, how so?
Well, they wouldn't have to shoulder the full cost of employing a professor full-time.
Right.
They could just contract with someone for a specific course or a series of courses.
Yeah, that makes sense, especially for smaller universities or universities that are trying to offer niche courses.
Exactly. So there's definitely potential there.
But of course, there are also potential downsides.
Oh, yeah. For sure.
So what are some of the concerns that you see with this model?
Well, the big one is the whole idea of prioritizing profit over educational value.
Right.
Because if universities are essentially shopping for the cheapest instructors,
right,
does that mean they're sacrificing quality?
Right, because the best instructors aren't always going to be the cheapest.
Exactly. And are students really getting the best education if the focus is on the bottom line rather than on their learning outcomes?
And it also raises questions about the role of education in society.
Mm.
Is it a public good that should be accessible to everyone? Or is it a commodity that could be bought and sold like any other product?
That's a really important debate, and this model kind of pushes us towards that commodification of education.
It really does.
Which is something we need to be mindful of.
Absolutely. And then Kasser also touches on how this contractor model could affect intellectual property.
Oh, yeah, that's a big one.
Especially when it comes to course materials.
Right, because who owns the updates and revisions?
Especially in a field like IT, where things are constantly changing.
Exactly. You need to be able to update the curriculum quickly to keep up with the latest technologies.
Right. So if a professor creates materials as part of their employment by a university, who owns those materials?
Right. It can get really murky.
Yeah. And Kasser actually suggests that this contractor model could simplify things.
Okay. How so?
Because the instructors would retain ownership of their courses.
Huh. So they'd be like independent consultants.
Exactly.
That's an interesting idea.
It is.
But it also raises a whole other set of questions.
Like what is...
Well, how do you manage intellectual property in a system where courses are constantly being created and updated by a network of independent contractors?
Right, because you don't want to stifle innovation.
Exactly. You want to encourage people to create new and exciting courses.
But you also need to protect their intellectual property.
Right. It's a balancing act.
It is. And then on top of all of that, we have to think about the student experience in all of this.
Oh, absolutely.
So would this model lead to a more fragmented and less cohesive educational journey for students?
That's a valid concern.
Because if they're taking courses from all these different instructors who are essentially independent contractors,
right,
are they really getting a unified educational experience?
Yeah, you need some sort of framework to ensure that everything fits together.
And there's continuity.
Exactly. So maybe there could be some kind of system for sharing and adapting course materials.
Okay.
While still respecting intellectual property rights.
So it's a really complex issue with no easy answers.
It definitely is.
And even beyond those logistical questions? Yes. There's this bigger philosophical question about what makes someone qualified to teach.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Especially in a field like IT that's constantly evolving.
Right, because a doctorate doesn't necessarily guarantee that someone is a good teacher.
Especially for adult learners.
Exactly. They often need someone who has real-world experience, who's been in the trenches.
Right. Someone who can connect the theory to practice.
Exactly. And Kasser actually argues that we should give more weight to practical experience and industry knowledge and less emphasis on those traditional academic credentials.
Which is interesting because we are seeing that happening more and more today.
We are.
With the rise of alternative credentials and boot camps.
Right, where the focus is on skills and experience.
Exactly.
And that's blurring the lines between traditional academia and industry.
It really is. And it raises this really important question.
What's that?
What truly makes someone qualified to teach? How do we balance those academic credentials with practical experience in a way that really benefits both the learners and the educators?
That's a question we could spend a whole other deep dive discussing.
We could.
But for now, I think we need to shift gears a bit.
Okay.
And dive into Kasser's thoughts on the role of technology in all of this.
Yeah, because he obviously saw the potential of the internet.
Right.
Even back in 2000.
So what did he have to say about how technology could shape this future of education that he envisioned?
Let's find out.
I'm curious.
Me too. Hashtag TTS, the deep dive episode 2024-1225, part 2 of 3.
So when it comes to technology, he really saw it as more than just delivering content.
Right.
He was really thinking about interactive learning environments.
And he even talks about asynchronous audio-enhanced PowerPoint presentations.
I mean, that's basically online video lectures today.
It is.
It's like he was looking into a crystal ball.
He really was. And he also saw the potential of those web-based forums.
Yeah, for discussion and collaboration.
Yeah, and now we have all these online learning platforms and communities.
It's amazing how he was able to see those trends emerging.
And he even talked about using synchronous voice communication for real-time interaction.
So like Zoom and all the video conferencing tools we use now.
It really is remarkable how he was able to anticipate all of that.
Yeah, he was definitely ahead of his time.
And what I found really interesting is that he understood that technology's impact wasn't just about the tools themselves.
Right. It's about transforming the whole learning experience.
Exactly. And he saw technology as this way to break down all those geographical barriers.
Yeah. Connect students and instructors from all over the world.
Create a true global learning community.
Yeah. And he even suggested that this could lead to a convergence of curricula.
Oh, so what's taught in fields like software engineering would become more standardized globally.
It's an interesting idea.
It is. So looking back from where we are now in 2024, how accurate were his predictions about technology's impact on education?
I think he was spot on with a lot of it.
Yeah.
I mean, look at online learning.
It's exploding.
Right. And collaboration tools are essential now.
For both in-person and remote learning.
And we have MOOCs.
Yeah. Massive open online courses.
Which have made education accessible to so many more people.
But they have faced challenges too.
Yeah. Like completion rates and student engagement.
Yeah. It's not a perfect solution.
But it's definitely been a game changer.
But we have virtual reality simulations, personalized learning platforms, all sorts of amazing things.
It's clear that technology has really transformed education.
But it also comes with its own set of challenges.
Oh, absolutely. Like what?
Well, access and equity is a big one.
Right. Not all students have equal access to technology or a reliable internet.
Yeah, which can create a digital divide and actually worsen existing inequalities.
That's a really important point. And even when students do have access,
right,
there's the potential for over-reliance on technology.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Distraction information overload.
There's a lot to navigate.
It is.
Yeah.
So we need to make sure that technology is being used effectively to enhance learning. Right, not just replace good teaching.
Exactly.
And Kasser actually brings up some of these potential pitfalls in the paper.
Oh, does he?
Yeah. He emphasizes that human connection is still essential.
Right.
And that instructors need to adapt their teaching methods.
To make the most of technology.
Exactly. It's not just about plugging in and playing.
Yeah, it requires thought and intention.
It does. So technology is a powerful tool, but it's not a cure-all.
I like that. And what about his idea of a global classroom leading to more standardized curricula?
Well, we are seeing some convergence,
okay.
especially in fields like software engineering,
right.
where there are global standards and certifications.
But at the same time, education is also influenced by cultural contexts and local needs.
So it's a bit of a balancing act?
It is. We want to prepare students for a globalized world.
Right.
But we also want to recognize the value of diverse perspectives and approaches.
And that brings us back to Kasser's overall message.
What's that?
The need for collaboration, innovation, and a willingness to challenge the status quo.
And technology can facilitate all of that.
It can, but it's up to educators, policymakers, and learners themselves to shape the future of education.
That's a good point. And his vision of a global classroom where students can learn from experts worldwide is so powerful.
It is.
And even with all the hurdles we've talked about, the progress we've made in the last two decades gives me hope that we're moving in the right direction.
I agree. And what's really striking is how relevant Kasser's paper still is today.
It is. It's a reminder that education is an ongoing journey.
Of exploration, adaptation, and collaboration.
This deep dive has really highlighted the importance of looking back to understand the present and the future.
Yeah, it's like we're digging for buried treasure.
And speaking of uncovering gems, Kasser brought up this interesting point about a potential barrier to this whole global collaborative vision of education.
What's that?
The tension between collaboration and competition in academia.
Ah, yeah, that's a tricky one.
It is, because how can you collaborate when you're also trying to stand out from the crowd?
It's a tough balance to strike. Hashtag TTS The Deep Dive, episode 2024-1225, part 3 of 3.
Yeah, it does seem counterintuitive in a way.
Like, it's the opposite of what we think about when we think about universities.
Right. They want to be known for their unique programs.
Their cutting-edge research.
So sharing resources and expertise can feel like they're losing their edge.
It's like those rival tech companies with their algorithms again.
Exactly. They guard those secrets fiercely.
And universities are kind of the same way with their knowledge.
Yeah. And then there's the whole issue of different institutional cultures.
That's right. Kasser mentioned that.
Each university has its own way of doing things.
Tradition.
Yeah.
Priorities.
Decision-making processes.
Trying to mesh all of that together, especially across international borders. It's a headache just thinking about it.
Yeah. And then there's the logistics of it all.
Oh, the logistics.
Coordinating curricula.
And for credit.
Scheduling classes across time zones.
Don't even get me started on time zones.
It makes my head spin.
And then the fund.
Right. Because who's going to pay for all of this?
International collaborations can be really tough to fund.
Universities are always strapped for cash.
So they have to weigh the potential benefits against the very real costs.
It seems like there's so many roadblocks.
There are.
Did Kasser offer any advice on how to overcome all of this?
He did. He suggested starting small.
Okay.
Maybe with institutions that already have some kind of partnership.
Like if they've collaborated on research projects before?
Exactly. Or they have a student exchange program.
Okay.
So there's already some trust built in.
So they're not starting from scratch.
Right. And by starting small, they can kind of prove the concept.
Show that collaboration can actually work.
And then hopefully that can create some momentum.
So other universities might be more willing to join in.
Exactly. It's about building trust and demonstrating the benefits.
Okay. So start small, build trust, and then expand from there.
That was Kasser's thinking.
And he also talked about the importance of strong leadership.
Oh, yeah. You need people who are really committed to this vision of collaboration.
People who are willing to fight for it.
Yeah. They have to be able to persuade the skeptics.
Navigate all those bureaucratic hurdles.
Inspire others to embrace new ways of doing things.
It sounds like a really tough job.
It is not for the faint of heart.
But if we want to see this global classroom become a reality,
we need those leaders.
This deep dive has been so eye-opening.
It has.
It's made me realize that the future of education is about so much more than just technology or new models.
It's about people.
The educators, the leaders, the students.
And their willingness to embrace change, collaborate, and really push the boundaries of what's possible.
It's really inspiring.
It is. And Kasser's paper, even though it's over 20 years old.
I know. It's amazing how relevant it still is.
It reminds us that education is this dynamic process, a journey of exploration and adaptation.
And who knows what the next 20 years will bring.
Maybe even more radical transformations in how we teach and learn.
It's exciting to think about.
It is. We're all part of shaping that future.
Well, that's a wrap on our deep dive into Joseph Kasser's predictions about the future of education.
It's been a fascinating journey.
We hope you found it insightful and maybe even a little bit inspiring.
And who knows, maybe it'll spark some new ideas and conversations about how we can create a truly global classroom.
One that empowers learners everywhere.
That's the goal.
Until our next deep dive, keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep learning.
I hope you enjoyed today's deep dive. Why not take a moment and join the discussion in the LinkedIn group, Tackling Complex Problems? Take care.